You're a hard act to follow, sir. Many congratulations. I think we're all struck by the immense pride you have in your land and of your people. We're humbled by the brilliance of your language and your use of it. I mean, that is an eye-opener for all of us, not least the Tunbridge First 11, I'm sure. And we're struck by your messages. Archbishop Desmond Tutu received a standing ovation in a different room to this one, and you've matched him. Kumo Sangakkara, thank you very much. Right. As it should be, ladies and gentlemen, a person whose cricket was of the highest standard, who led her country with a stature and a meaning that defined its future, but who's gone on in her second career within the game to even greater heights, now running the women's game and playing an important role in many other parts of the game globally. Our first guest, Claire Connor. Anybody called Whispering Death has to be good and has to be dangerous. Michael Holding, ladies and gentlemen. Our 2011 Cowdery lecturer, Kumo Sangakkara. And the captain of England, Andrew Strauss. Hello. Right, well, while we recover, let's lighten things up a bit. Are you champing at the bit now that you've retired from the one-day game? Are you looking at those losses and thinking, oh, maybe I should still be a part of that, or I could do something about that, or...?
I think because as an England captain, you invest so much with your team, you still have a great regard for it and a great wish for the side to be doing well. But I think it's important to realise that the end of the World Cup is the end of a cycle, and post-World Cup's the start of a new cycle. And therefore, I think it's wrong to expect the England side to suddenly be the best side in the world. There's a lot of hard work necessary. Alistair Cook and Annie Flower have got a fairly blank canvas from which to work to move forward, but it's going to take some time, and it's going to be a hell of a lot of hard work, and we will have good days and we'll have bad days, and over time we'll get better. So I'm very, very confident that'll happen. I'm going to try and help out in any way I possibly can, but patience is necessary.
Are you champing at the bit?
Look, I miss it, but... You know, the reason that I gave up the game was to concentrate on the rest of my test career and hopefully elongate it. And I'm pretty certain that that can happen. And I'm concentrating my energies on doing that.
All right. Charlotte Edwards and your girls are doing fantastically well.
They are. They're in the midst of an international quadrangular tournament at the moment, featuring Australia, New Zealand, India and England. Which is a really great kind of timing for that event because it's midway between ICC global events. So a good gauge to see where we are, and we're unbeaten in six games at the moment. So the 2020s were won on Monday at the Rose Bowl after some really great coverage from Sky. We played double headers with the England men's team on Saturday at Bristol in front of 9,000 people, which was wonderful for the players. And we're midway through the 50-over tournament at the moment. We're playing here tomorrow against Australia, and then in the final on Thursday at Wormsley, also against Australia, which we know already. So
just in
general, going really well.
In general of late, you've, a bit like the fellas, you've had the Aussies covered, haven't you?
We're doing okay. Yeah, we're doing okay. The tour down under over the winter, we beat them 4-1 in the 2020 series, lost 2-1 in the one-dayers, and lost the one-off test match.
Unusual test match to lose, really, because you were dominating it for a long period.
Yeah, it was a shame. It was a one-off test match. That's all in the balance, the future of women's test cricket, hugely, because we don't play very much and we don't play any domestic multi-day cricket at all. But the limited over stuff is going brilliantly.
All in the balance, the future of test cricket, Mikey. That could apply to the West Indies. I just wondered if you listened to Kumar and thought of to the West Indian Islands, his tale of a small island with its own identity is one that must resonate with you.
Certainly, and what he was saying about what was happening with his board, it certainly has struck a chord with me, because I think we have similar problems in the Caribbean. I think a lot of West Indian cricketers and former cricketers will express the same thoughts that Kumar is expressing about the direction of our board and what is happening within our board. And what has happened, as I jokingly joked with a gentleman from TWI when I was in the Caribbean doing the Pakistan series, that they were the ones who brought money into our cricket and they were the ones who started the destruction. But as Kumar says, hopefully we'll be able to solve that problem ourselves, and hopefully we'll get back to where we belong.
Is everybody picking up Mikey okay? No, I didn't. I'm not sure that Michael Holding's microphone is bang on. So while he's on that, it's a hell of a view, particularly if it's walking away from you. I mean, just bowled a ball at 110 mph.
I hope everyone is hearing though.
Yeah.
Is that better?
Okay. Wow, the voice of silk. Listen to that. Marvelous. How did Murali deal with the accusations that were thrown at him? Was the only thing that I'm interested to know from your lecture as an adjunct to it. The man must have been creased internally so often, and yet he kept coming back. How at any stage did you see him down enough to be concerned about him?
No, I think at the initial stages, I wasn't a part of the team when he was first called, but Murray has told me that at that time, he felt as if his career was over. He felt that that was the last ball he'll ever bowl, and that he'll never be able to play cricket again. But the one thing he appreciated and what brought him back, he said, was the support he received from the team and Arjuna and the people. And for him, that was the one thing that gave him the courage to get tested, not just once, but over and over again. And once in Australia, there was this biomechanist who wrote an article saying, well, Murray bowls his Dusra at this speed, he must be chucking it. And the next day when we turned up for training, we couldn't find Murali. He turns up in the evening and I asked him where he went. He said, oh, I just went to meet that guy and I just offered him the opportunity to test me. And I was thinking, well, are you mad? But for Murali, that was also a motivating factor to prove everyone wrong, to show what he could do, that he could do it well, and within the limits set.
I thought Shane Warne made an interesting point in an interview recently, or actually as long as a year ago, about Murali, when he said it's sort of become irrelevant, the legitimacy of the action. It's now just an issue of celebrating an amazing man and cricketer. And I get the impression in the game that all those doubts and those questions and that antagonism, particularly of the late 90s, has long gone from the cricketers who've played with him and against him.
Oh, yeah, I couldn't agree anymore. I mean, it's been one of the sort of great challenges and honours of my career to play against Murali and Shane Warne. And you look at what they've achieved in the game and you realise that they are true greats of the game. And as you correctly say, I mean, Murali's had to deal with all this other stuff off the field, people questioning him, which must have made it so much harder for him to go out and perform so consistently. So, you know, it's a subject that's passed a long time ago.
Widely loved, isn't it?
And, I mean, you know, he finished in a fantastic manner, in a manner that befitted a man of his substance and what he'd achieved in the game.
Had he and Warne bowled with the decision review system in place for the whole of their careers, heaven only knows, with the LBWs. Claire, you're on a big committee.
I'm on the committee that Mikey stepped off, actually.
Yeah, you've... Yeah. I don't know how to rationalise that. The ICC have just concluded their annual board meeting in Hong Kong, and the decision review system has played an enormous part in that meeting. I suspect you had your moment right at the start of the lecture when you had a stern word to say to India. But I may be being unfair there. But India refused to embrace ball tracking, so we will have a piece of the decision review system as we know it, but not all of it. Is it fair to ask you if the recommendations of the cricket committee are different from those which come out of the main board as a result of those deliberations?
Tiny bit, perhaps, not a tiny bit unfair.
A tiny bit different. Is it something that the cricket committee spend a great deal of time on? Rationalising the DRS and getting it forward, taking it forward, must be very complicated.
I think virtually day one of the recent set of meetings, 2 days of meetings, were on the DRS with presentations from Hawkeye, looking at a huge amount of footage, looking at statistics, looking at decisions and percentages of correct decisions, and looking at how to further develop the use of DRS and in the test game where it can be used, facilities and budgets permitting, and how it can be used best in ODI cricket as well.
It may be that some in the room aren't aware that the position now is that all the teams in the world will use the DRS system. The DRS, in its entirety, except for India, who are not embracing ball tracking technology, i.e. the LBW mat and the predicted path of the ball. Do you have any sympathy with the Indians?
No, not at all. But... but to be honest, I have never really been a fan of the projected path of the ball. I think what Hawkeye has produced with the actual path of the ball and where the ball has landed and where it has gone on to hit, whatever, whether it's the bat or the pad, I have been 100% happy with that. The projected path of the ball is a calculation. And obviously has a margin of error. They won't call it a margin of error because they don't want to hear the word error. So that is why whenever it is hitting the stumps or projected to be hitting the stumps, not full on, they leave it to the umpire's call, whatever the umpire had said previously to it being referred. So if you're going to leave it to the umpire's call, that means you are thinking that whatever you are showing is not 100% correct. And I don't believe in going to technology that is going to then start thinking, if it's not 100% correct, why should I use it? So everything but the projected path I've been happy with. And I cannot understand why India do not want to use a mat. That mat is placed there by an immovable camera. That camera doesn't move. That is what puts the mat there. Where the ball is being pitched, that has been shown to be 100% correct with the pathway of the ball. So I have no problem with that. I don't see why India should not want to use it.
Could it be anything to do with protection of their best players?
That is a possibility, but I don't want to speculate. All I would say is they have too much power, as Kumar was intimating earlier on. I do not believe any country should be able to dictate to the rest of the world in the whatever sport it is. Coming from the Jamaica and the Caribbean, we have been fans of Brazilian football for years. Brazilian dominated football for many decades, or not decades, but many World Cups. They could not go to FIFA and say, this is what we want in the next World Cup. They could never, ever dictate the path of anything. The organization that runs the sport, as far as I'm concerned, is the organization that should dictate the path. And I'm seeing where individual boards are dictating certain things, which I cannot agree with.
So you stood down from the ICC Cricket Committee because you felt that the balance was wrong?
Well, not because of that specific situation, but because of the cricket committee, who was made up of former cricketers and people involved in the game, who then suggested something. Well, let us be specific. Pakistan-England test match at the Oval. We suggested when it was...
The one that was abandoned?
The abandoned test
match. And given to England.
Given to England. We suggested that it should remain as an England victory. It went to the executive committee, who decided, no, it's a draw. And I know it was because of political reasons. You scratch my back, I will scratch yours. And I am not into that. So I wrote to them and told them, I have nothing more to do with the cricket committee because, and just recently, an officer of the BCCI, when he heard that some of the recommendations from the cricket committee to the board, flippantly said, oh, that's just the cricket committee. Now, why would I want to be a part of something that's just a cricket committee? If the recommendations coming from those well-respected people on the cricket committee, I nearly said gentlemen, sorry, are just going to be thought of as just from the cricket committee. I have better things to do with my time.
I'm glad I asked, Mikey. I understand that, and I'm not going to push you on that subject, but what I am interested in is whether you're comfortable, the two of you, as current players, with players challenging, and that's what they are. I know that it's called the DRS for whatever platitude it may be, but it's a player challenge. Are you comfortable with it as it is, or do you think there's still an argument that says it should be left to three umpires to sort it out with their talk back and their replays and working together as one?
I actually think that it is... Of course, it adds to the spectacle of the game and the players can challenge it. The crowd likes it, and it gives the captains decisions to make, some of them strategic as to when and against which players you might use your calls. But at the same time, I'm a great believer in leaving it to the three umpires. If they need assistance to make their decision, let them ask for that and allow the three umpires to sort it out between themselves. Uh-huh.
All right, interesting. Andrew?
Well, I must admit, I had problems with it when it was first muted. I worried about the players being involved in the decision-making process. It was kind of very contrary to what the game of cricket was all about, which was the umpires made the final decision. But having seen it work and having seen umpires get used to the idea, I don't think they feel so much undermined now. A lot of the time, the best umpires actually come out with their reputations enhanced by the DRS. I think everyone's got used to it. I think we get more decisions right as a result of it, and therefore it's for the betterment of the game of cricket.
Before I forget, on a different note, we heard Kumar talk about when he first seriously thought how much he wanted to play for his country. Do you remember that moment yourself?
I think actually it was Mike Gatting bringing back the Ashes in 1986. That was my first really strong memory of English cricket and what it meant when England did well in cricket. And, you know, subsequent to that, England had a lot of downtime, some up times, but that kind of ignited the interest.
Were you people who... There's a misconception about Andrew that he spent a lot of his young life in South Africa. You actually went to prep school at Caldecott. So you went to Caldecott and Radley. Where were you when Gat was...
That's when I was in England.
You'd come to England. Yeah, you'd come to England. And do you remember when you first thought, I want to do this?
Yeah, it was whilst I was playing a lot of boys' cricket. I was playing for Brighton College First 11, and I was 17 when the England women's team won the World Cup here against New Zealand, and it was all over the morning news, front page news. And I wasn't really aware of women's cricket and what you could go on and do within the women's game, but it fired my imagination hugely.
And did you bowl fast as a boy, or did you sprint and hurdle, or?
I did everything.
You did everything, yeah, you did.
And I'm a bit different. I never aspired to be a West Indies cricketer. I played sports and I did whatever was available. I spent all of my daylight hours outside. I never wanted to be indoors once the sun was shining. And whatever was going on, I played. I would ride the skate in the gully, I would play marbles, I would play cricket, football, whatever was going. As a matter of fact, at age 21, when I was first ever selected for the West Indies team to go to Australia, I was a little bit disappointed, to be honest, because this is weird. But I grew up in such a close-knit family in Jamaica, and the first thought that came to me when I was selected to go to Australia was that I was going to be away for Christmas. And to be honest, it was not a welcoming thought. But, you know, you play for your country, you get to enjoy the team that you are with and the guys that you play with, it becomes another family. And so time moves on and you went on and you enjoyed it. But my initial response was not one of joy, I'm great, I'm going to play for the West Indies.
The homesick Mr. Death. go on.
No, go ahead.
I wanted to say, so now that you've got this dream and you're growing up, did you feel that women were patronised as cricketers? It's a different world now for women who are so much more accepted within cricket's inner family.
I didn't feel it once, no. I've often been asked that and been asked what it was like to grow up being a girl at the cricket club, and all I wanted to do was play cricket and you know, mum was asking me to help her make the teas, and I was saying, no, I'm going to go and practice with dad, and all of that kind of stuff. I had no concept that it was unusual at all when I was little, and I think that must have been to the because of the complete kind of unconditional support of my parents, my family, coaches, teachers, all that kind of thing. For me, it was just the most normal thing that I would go on and play cricket at the highest level I could, and I think I was incredibly lucky to have had those experiences. And I think the beauty now for girls growing up being inspired by Charlotte Edwards or whoever it is that they can all play, as Kumar was referring to, in terms of moving cricket from the elite sector to the public schools, the state schools or whatever. Girls can now do that through Chance to Shine, and that's just the most fabulous opportunity.
And lots of the England women's team coach in those schools. They do a massive job. I heard you being interviewed recently and talking about the primacy of Test match cricket and the importance of it. It's obviously something close to your heart, but equally you play in the IPL. And the IPL interrupts a future tours program. It even interrupts a Sri Lankan tour of England, so you arrived here a little late. How do you reconcile that position?
Well, I think arriving in England a little late, again, we are contracted to the cricket board, and every single contract we sign with the IPL is subordinate to our national contracts. And we were just waiting for the board to tell us, come on the 8th, we'd come on the 8th, come on the 10th, we'll come on the 10th. The board needs to tell us exactly when they want us here and when the squad meets together to train. At the same time, I believe that if you're a cricketer of any worth, the format you must aspire to play is Test cricket. At the end of your career, no one's going to talk about how much money you made or you were sold off at an auction for, but they will talk about your wickets and the runs you've scored. Yeah. And there is no greater pride than walking out there with a Test cap on and playing against the best sides in the world. But at the same time, to add to that, I think 2020 cricket, and, you know, it's great. The money's good for the players and for the boards. Why not use that to sustain Test cricket if it is financially not becoming,
In what way? How would you go about that?
I think with cricket boards, I think they should, all cricket boards should aspire to have equity in private enterprises that actually go to countries and promote T20 cricket as leagues. And I think the ICC needs to only organise the T20 World Cup every 2 years and let T20 cricket run as a franchise-based competition.
So it's a business model you're talking about.
It's a business model where the finances gained from that can be injected into sustaining Test cricket. And this time in the IPL, there was something akin to that happened, because the boards acted as the agents for the players and they received 10% of over and above what the players were paid. So the boards were getting a direct benefit. And for us, the question was that money should go to playing the club cricketers in Sri Lanka, because our club cricketers play a match now for $45 a game. This is our best first-class cricket in Sri Lanka, the provincial tournament or the club tournament. They earn $45 a game, which does not even allow them to buy a bat at the end of the season.
I didn't ask you the question of your own reconciliation as an accusation. I was interested in how demanding it must be on you and how difficult it must be to thread your way through that. Callum, how do you look at, you know, an England player like Owen Morgan, who's going to now be in the Test side, the one-day side, the 2020 side, and have a chance to make all this money in the IPL? I mean, the world, the canvas has changed dramatically even since you began.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, individual players will have individual decisions to make about which route they want their career to go down. I think when we are managing a Test side or an international team, all you can say is what is in the best interest of our side going forward. And that's how you decide when players should go, if they should go to IPL, to what extent they can stay there, all that sort of stuff. And that's always been our sort of abiding concern. And then the players individually have the option of saying, well, I don't like that, I'm going to go and play for the IPL for the full time. Well, that's their decision to make. And, you know, if they want to do that, then they've got to understand they can't have the best of both worlds.
Let's loosen it off to finish up. I couldn't help but pick up on a word you used, flair. And I love that conception of Sri Lanka and flair. When I first went there, it felt to me like first going to Barbados with cricket on the beach and in the streets, and everybody seemed to play the game with an individuality that was every bit as strong as it was, say, when I first went to Barbados in the early 80s. What are the moments and the flair players. Who are the flair players that have most thrilled you? Who have you watched and you thought, yes, that's the model for young cricketers and these guys that are here and the next generation? Mikey, start with you, because you played in a team that was just riddled with flair.
Yes, but early in my career, when I was a young man, I was impressed by some overseas cricketers, as you may call it, non-West Indians. I played my first test series against Australia, and I came up a young man, not a young man at the time. I was a young man. As a young man, I came up against Ian Chappell, who I thought was a flair player, because Ian Chappell certainly did not bat by the book and did not bat the orthodox style. But since then, there have been so many, Mark. When you think of the kind of players that Pakistan produced, like Zahir Abbas, I am so happy I never played a test match against him. I played a few one-day internationals, but never a test match. And then when you think of people like Majid Khan, then you move on to India, Sunil Gavaskar. I played a test match against Sunil Gavaskar in Madras,
Chennai.
Chennai. It was Madras in my time.
And it'll be Madras forever, Mo.
Forever. A flat pitch, he got 250 runs. Now, when you play against people on those sort of pitches, you think that it's best to pull a hamstring muscle and get off. But in the West Indies team, now, when you think of people like IBA Richards, unbelievable. I stood at the opposite end to him once in a one-day international at Old Trafford, and I was in awe. And then in recent times, Sachin Tendulkar, and of course, Brian Charles Lara. I am a big fan of Brian Charles Lara as a batsman. People will know other things I'm not a big fan of, but as a batsman, he was fantastic. The best player of spin bowling and medium pace bowling I have ever seen. And when I say see, I'm not talking about people that I have seen or played against. I'm talking about him in the West Indies team. I do not think Viv Richards could play spin and medium pace bowling as good as Brian Lara, but as an all-round batsman against everyone, IBA Richards. So, you know, you're talking about some outstanding cricketers that I've seen.
You've picked batsmen, not bowlers, I'm interested.
Bowlers, they're all just
They're just the workhorses.
Kumar, we all know what the game is about, Mark, batting.
You mentioned Tenakoon, you've talked about Sanath and Damela. Are there any outside of Sri Lanka that you watched as a boy and you thought, yeah, I'll have some of that?
I think, again, IBA Richards. In Sri Lanka, it was strange. Growing up, I supported the West Indies more than I did the Sri Lankan side. So I was very disappointed once, I think, when we beat the West Indies in a one-day game in Colombo, and I was thinking, God, West Indies lost. But I agree with Michael completely. Growing up, Sir Vivian Richards was my idol. But again, the batsman I would watch any day, there are two. One is Sanat Jayasuriya, and the other is Brian Charles Lara. I've never seen two players like them, and I don't think we will again.
Right. Strassi?
Well, I'm not going to be very original here, because for me, my sort of formative years growing up, I remember Lara getting his 375 against England and then coming to county cricket and getting 800 in a row and that 501. And he was doing stuff that was completely unprecedented in the game of cricket, and he did it in a manner that was so unorthodox. I mean, during one of the many rain delays we had over the last month or so, there was some footage of him batting in Australia. And I was thinking, how can you even begin to coach someone to bat like that? It was all feel, it was all hands, massive movements all around the crease. But he had that touch of genius that allowed him to do anything to any bowler. And, that's something that you just can't teach, and something that, for those of us that have to grind it out week after week, we always aspire to be like
Well,
that.
We watched you make 150 against India in the one day in the World
Cup. Just to add to that, once I was playing a charity game for the tsunami again, and this was at the MCG, I was in a side that was opposed to Brian Lara and Sachin Tendulkar. And in my side, I had a very senior and a great batsman from India. And he was standing at slip and he was talking. And Sachin came, batted, got out left, and Brian Lara walks in, and he tells me in a hushed voice, "This is the guy, this is the man, he's my favorite batsman." And I was, "What do you mean? You're not Sachin?" And he goes, "No." It's Brian Chancellor.
So you have to break the news to us. We can't all go home now. You'll have to tell us. Who is that? A senior Indian batsman.
It is Rahul Dravid.
Thank you very much. I love the Brian Lara when he played Durham in that innings of 501. He got to 15. And he nicked a Durham seamer to Chris Scott, the wicketkeeper, as easy as they come here, and it bounced out. And Scott turned to Wayne Larkins at slip and said, "Oh, God, I suppose you're going to get 100 now." 501. Claire, who were the Flair players that you watched either on television or live? I don't know if you went much to Hove.
I did. I spent a lot of my childhood sitting at the northwest corner of the ground with my grandfather watching Imran and Garth LaRue bowling in tandem at Hove, yeah. Which was pretty special. But I think when I was little as well, watching the highlights of the 81 Ashes series and watching both of them, and then I used to just watch it over on video, was just fantastic. I was really, really lucky. Some of the greatest names that I grew up watching, I was lucky enough to play with. When I stopped playing for England, I played about 40 games for Lashings, the Lashings World 11. I played 3 games with Tendulkar, played with Ranatunga, Chris, when we were in the Isle of Wight. Ranatunga played for Lashings, Chris Cairns.
Great.
Unbelievable. It's the real stuff of dreams. Yeah. To finish playing for England and then to go on and play with those guys was amazing. Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, just to remind you that MCC continues to partner the IPL and the Champions League 2020, bringing the spirit of cricket message. And you might wonder why 2020 tournaments. Well, of course, at present, they're the ones that the most people watch, and that's the best opportunity to spread the spirit of cricket message. And MCC are about to begin a similar association with the new Sri Lankan Premier League, and Kumar, I'm sure, will be involved in that. At the grassroots level, MCC continues to be involved with the Cricket Foundation and the Chance to Shine initiative. We heard Kumar with the words, "Play hard, play fair, and have fun," and that is the quote that Chance to Shine uses. We coach in the classrooms, the school competitions, the running of summer camps, and pushing the message of respect for the game, for yourself and for your opponent. And this year, it's gone a stage further, and the initiative is going into MCC school assemblies, and players and coaches are talking to assemblies and showing the film that you've seen and then chatting to the kids about our great game. So there's still an awful lot going on with the MCC and Chance to Shine. We've had a lovely evening for some of you going to dinner. There's more to come. We've had a splendid panel, Michael Holding, Claire Connor, Andrew Strauss, and if Adam Gilchrist hadn't been born, I think he would be the greatest wicketkeeper batsman of them all, but it's tight. Certainly our greatest lecturer, Kumar Sangakkara. To all of you, thank you.